Now, Corinthians as a letter is a letter of correction. So we won't be surprised if the tone of what we receive is correctional. And, you know, we don't find that necessarily very welcome, don't we? We don't have somebody sort of point us in the other way. But it's here for a reason. God has put the letter in here for a reason, to lead us, to challenge us, to direct us. It's good to hear it. We've got a new season coming, haven't we? You know, September, the new season going up to Christmas. Let's just come before the Lord and ask him if there's something you need to say to us. Lord, speak to us. And here in 1 Corinthians, you have this concern, this burden the apostle brings to the church. Because they've become what he calls worldly. Worldly. You see, in the 50s and 60s, there was a sense that being worldly was wearing a skirt that was too long or short. You chewed gum. Definitely worldly if you chewed gum. All those sort of things. And mostly the focus was on the externals. But here, it's their hearts. It's their attitudes. It's on the things that they put the priorities. And it seems that they seem to be considering people, themselves, the self itself, the self, as being more precious than Christ. He's not first in their hearts. And that's what he calls worldly. That's what he calls being carnal or fleshly. When you are more important in your life, in your thinking, in your attitudes, in what you do, than him. I mean, there's got to be something that everybody needs to hear from time to time and consider from time to time. And I think in the West, in the Western world at the moment, in Western Christianity at the moment, we have to be so careful, don't we? And imagine you've got the church, but it's lost its savour, it's lost its message, it's lost its power. You know, the people out here on our doorstep, they don't know about the future, they don't know what the future holds. You know. They don't know that there's a way of salvation. They don't understand it. You do. We've got work to do. It's not all about evangelism. We've got to build ourselves up. We've got to learn. We've got to love God together and share our burdens together and all that sort of thing. But the outworking of it all is to do the work that God has called us to do. And I feel, as I read through this passage, the sense of disappointment and disappointed expectation that the apostle has. He's planted this church, he started this church, he worked hard, he labored, he invested into the church, and then he comes to it a few years later, and it just seems to have just lost its way. Lost its way. Like Jesus when he comes to the fig tree. Again, we haven't got Phil in the room. We need Phil in the room. I hope you can hear this on the overhead. Remember his fig tree in the Mark drama? Oh, I'm sorry. You were the fig tree, weren't you? And Phil came to find the fig. Is that right? Was it Phil or was it Glyn, maybe? Glyn coming to find the figs. Looking for figs. There was no figs. Disappointed expectations. And the real sorrow of it all is that we, if this affects us, and this does affect us from time to time, and churches and whole societies can get involved in this, it's us that lose out. It's us that lose out, and many others too. We've got a call. I was thinking of the ultimate unfulfilled expectation illustration this morning. And I haven't had an opportunity to use this yet, but when I remember looking at it and I was thinking, this is going to appear in a million sermons at some point. 7-0. Does that mean anything to anybody? Brazil, the greatest footballing nation in the world. Having the World Cup final, the World Cup in their own nation. Having brought themselves up from the economic basins into the top 12 economic powers of the world, conflicted and yet investing in their hopes and their aspirations to be recognized through the world, onto 11 men running around on a little grass pitch. And look at if you've saw them, they look like, inverted, small g, like they look like gods. All the players, they're handsome and athletic, and each has got their own distinctive hairdo. everybody's expectations was invested. And do you remember what happened? The first game, they scored an own goal. The first goal that Brazil scored was an own goal. It's like, I'm just going to ignore that. That was a mistake. This doesn't really happen. This is Brazil. They're going to win. Da, 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 da. Everybody's expecting this country to show us how to play football. Show the world how to play football. And then they met Germany. Now, I cannot tell the difference between one German player and another. I don't know why. Maybe I haven't looked closely enough. But they all look the same to me. They all look gaunt and hungry and very thin and just kind of... They don't draw my eye in the way that the Brazilian team drew my eye. But they came out there and they just annihilated Brazil in front of the whole world. Goal after goal after goal after goal after goal after goal after goal, 7-0. And suddenly I realized that they weren't gods after all. They were just people who spent too long in the hairdressers. And that the Germans have been training really hard. And they wanted it really bad. And they were a team. They said it was 12 players against one team. Sorry, 11 players against one team. And that was the difference. They just worked together and they won. And the Brazilians were just all over the place. And they looked like a load of just big babies. Out of their depth. Out of their depth. The world needs the church. The world needs our message. We're much more important than football. This is much more important than football, isn't it? And the Christians that he's writing to, and you see it in verse 1 as we start to open up the passage there, he's shocked and appalled by how disappointing their spirituality is, how their lack of spirituality, how unspiritual these people appear to be. He wants to talk to them like this, but he can't. He has to keep talking to them like this all the time, all the time. It's like a bunch of big babies. They're like a load of big babies. He reasonably expects that they would have grown up. Grown up. And what's really so concerning about what he finds amongst them, as we'll have a look at, is that they think they're doing fine. And that's the problem. That is the problem, isn't it? When we think we're strong, when we think we've got it, when we think we're okay, that is the time when we ought to be really concerned. It's like this kind of, it's all right, God, thank you for saving me. I'll take it from here. I got this. I got this nailed. I got this covered. I'm all right. Thanks for everything. You know that is going to end badly, don't you? You know that's going to end badly. There's been a big drive on, speaking particularly the chaps here for a moment, there's been a big drive on to us, a big appeal being made to us, but from certain corners, to kind of engage with what you might call muscular Christianity. Has any of you been approached by this? Well, there are books coming out that us guys, we should be getting together and going shooting together or something. Buy some rifles, go up north, eat raw meat, shoot moose, that kind of thing, you know. And kind of just become a little bit more kind of hunky, right? And this is the problem in Christianity right now, okay? That us guys, we're just not, you know, when we are weak, I'm not saying we should try to make ourselves, but the reality, the power of what we have is that we are weak, but he is strong. That's what we've got. You know, I don't care how long you spend in the gym, right? How fit, how tough you are, how muscular you are. When you go out onto the battlefield, you want to be wearing a helmet, right? You want to have body armor on. You need defense. We need a shield. We need a fortress. We need a tank. We need Jesus. We need protecting. And he is our protection, isn't he? And when we get so self-confident and so self-assured that we think we don't need him, I'm telling you, that's not the way. That's not the answer. Weakness is normal. Knowing your weakness, recognizing your weakness, being comfortable with your weakness, that is strength. Being a vulnerable person. If you want to love somebody, you know you have to make yourself vulnerable. If you want to start a family and invest into life, you have to make yourself vulnerable. If you want to start a business and do something, you make yourself vulnerable. If you want life, you're at risk, and you take that risk, and you say, Christ, I'm trusting you here. You look after me. I'm weak, but you are strong. And, you know, Christ has made available to us means by which we can be strengthened and given grace, hasn't he? You know, the Bible, reading our Bible, that's why the survey is so devastating. There it is, you can see this like long shelf with all these Bibles on the shelf. And they're just pristine. You know when you see a Bible and the spine is pristine and you can look at the pages, they still stick together. The old ink still sticks together. They're just never opened. Has God spoken for nothing? Is there a reason? Has he given us his word so that, well, you know, if you're interested, if you feel like it, on occasions, special occasions maybe, when it's because we are in need. We need his word. We need to be dependent. And these people have become so full of self. I follow Paul. I follow Apollos. They seem to think people are the answer. And what they're belying when they say that, investing that confidence in others, is that they believe self, people, can be the answers to their problems. That they themselves are that important. And the fact that they think these people are going in different directions and so on, they're willing to take these different directions to be pulled this way and the other because self is asserting itself. Whereas if you settle for Christ and you follow Christ, there's unity and there is peace and there is direction. There's only one way we're going to be saved. And it's not through anybody here in this room. It's him. It's him alone. It's him alone. And when you get carnal and you get worldly and you get fleshly, you will find almost any excuse. Almost any excuse. I've got a cold. The weather's not right. I don't know what. You just come up with anything. But really, underneath all those excuses, which are so appealing, and nobody can say anything about it because you're kind of shutting the door. You've made your excuses. You shut the door. But behind that excuse is the assertion of yourself, your own self-reliance, your own self-dependence. I'm doing this. I'm doing it. I know the way I'm going. I know the way I'm going. And nobody can tell me. I'm following this way, I'm following that way, I'm going here, I'm going there. But the apostle is mourning. Look at him in chapter 3, verse 1. He calls them brothers. It'd be lovely if we were talking about non-Christians here. Wouldn't it be convenient if we were talking about non-Christians? He's not. He's talking to Christians. He's talking to a whole church, a group of believers. And he is absolutely heartbroken at what he finds, isn't he? Heartbroken. Brothers. He calls them brothers. And then he says, but you're just like big babies, like infants. What disappointments. What a disappointment he finds. When we did the service in the back room, you can see into the field and the hedges and all the rest of it. And I'm sure there's a few blackbirds nesting in the hedges there. And one of those blackbirds out there, as they make their little nest, is going to lay a few eggs. And they're going to look in there. And Mr. Blackbird is going to say to Mrs. Blackbird, darling, I'm so proud. What wonderful eggs you've laid. They're bigger. I've got this beautiful big egg in the middle of our nest. It's bigger than all the others. And it's bigger than all the eggs in all the nests, in all the neighbours. I'm just so proud of you, darling. She says, oh, darling, I'm sure it's all from you and all the rest of it. And they feel wonderful in this lovely, beautiful egg, and the egg grows and hatches, and she sits on the egg and it hatches. And out comes this beautiful, great big chick. Oh, darling, look at this beautiful, great big chick that we've got. Oh, we're so hungry. He's hungrier than all the other chicks, and we must feed him. And he flies, and he wearies himself out, running backwards and forwards, feeding worm after worm. And the little other chicks aren't growing as fast. Well, they're not so interesting, and they're not so attractive, are they? Whereas, what a wonderful chick we've got here. More and more food, and more. She's getting tired. But, oh, look how he's growing. Isn't he so handsome and strong and all the rest of it? And suddenly one of the other chicks has gone from the nest, has been pushed out of the nest, and then before you know it, another chick has gone out of the nest, and there's this one great big, you know what's happened, they've been cuckooed, haven't they? They've been feeding the wrong thing. They've been feeding self. They've been feeding somebody else's child instead of feeding the things that God has given them, and taking full advantage and investing themselves into that. And they've been made fools out of. And they're too sweet and too innocent, aren't they? The little blackbird. And we can be like that. It creeps up on us and we're deceived and we don't realize that our spiritual vigor, our spiritual life, our real dependence, we become independent and self-confident. It's all about us. And that's what was happening in the church. You remember when Parakeet was speaking, she was talking to us about the church in Hong Kong. Do you remember when she was talking about that? She said her church was 500 strong. It had grown from about 20 or 30 people in a couple of decades and was now 500 strong. But she said to me that it's plateaued, that people aren't really, it's not really growing anymore. That's a great church. Who'd be 500? We're 500. We've got 500 in our church. But it's not growing. And the passion for evangelism has waned. And the desire to reach the lost in the prayer meetings is tapered. And people aren't coming to church. They're not bringing people to church. And why? Why? What's going on? They're investing in their education, their children's education, in the new car and the holiday, materialism. They're feeding it. The great opportunities they have that they didn't have and their previous generations didn't have. And they're putting their life and their time and their efforts into it. It's getting bigger. Cheap, cheap. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with you know, I'm not trying to say one, but you can end up without realizing it, you can end up so consumed. Your time, your effort, your priorities get so consumed. And I don't know about you, but I think the world is absolutely wonderful. I'm ravished by the world. I think it's fascinating and beautiful and interesting and intriguing. There's so many things to discover. It seems endless, actually, doesn't it? There are just so many books to read and films to watch and games to play. And it's just fantastic. And I tell you, it is so wonderful that I will be absolutely captivated by it and taken off. And I will become a lover of the world in no time at all. And there's something or someone more beautiful, more powerful, more ravishing, storms my heart, woos me and gets a hold of me and will not let me go. I need Christ. I need Christ to deliver me from my own natural tendency to just to love the world in all its loveliness and to be saved from the love of the world and to becoming completely carnal and becoming a Christian couch potato. Because the truth is, the love of God is so great, it is so great, that I don't have to respond to his love in order to be saved in that sense. I am saved. I know I am. I have an assurance of my salvation. And I am going to heaven. And I don't have to contribute to that at all. And I can sit on my spiritual couch and watch spiritual TV for the rest of my life. But the Spirit in me will not let that rest. Keep stirring me up. And I have to keep silencing the door of my conscience all the days of my life to live a life like that because of what Christ has done for me. It's changed my life. It's changed my heart. So frustrating. And we do, we brush off his advances, don't we? We brush them off. What did he say to the church in Ephesus? He says, you've lost your first love. Wouldn't that be the worst thing? Having started with Christ, as this church started with Christ, the good foundation of Jesus Christ, that they then go on and just lose that love and lose that relationship in the midst of it all. Yes, he still loves you. Yes, he still loves his church. But what are we losing? What would we be losing? The world, he says. You've become worldly in verse 1. Everything looks good, it sounds good, tastes good, feels good, smells good. But we read and know and believe that it's God that is good and the giver of every good gift. He's better. If the horse is good, then the maker of the horse is better. If the mountains are glorious, then he who founded them, isn't he more glorious? But we can't see him except by the eyes of faith. Only by faith alone. We're in a struggle, aren't we, between our instincts, and we have to assert a measure of self-control. We have to control ourselves, because ourselves will run away with us, and we will be made fools of by ourselves. There is a culture at work right now. I know I'm not particularly sticking very close to the text, I think, but I'm faithful to the underlying message he was bringing to the church. Right now, there is a brat culture at work in our society. It's impatient and demanding and restless. We have to be aware of the fact there's a low tolerance to discipline or pain or demand. And it'll get into us. It'll get under our skin. It'll become part of us. And I'm not trying to make a rant or a guilt trip to anybody today, but it'll be us that loses out. That's why I'm saying it. That's why I'm saying it. You know, when you see people who just can't cope with life as it is, they've never known what it is to have the wind in their hairs or a quiet thought in their mind, just doesn't forgotten what it is to feel the love of God. The love of God that surpasses all understanding, guarding their hearts and minds. The truth is, as we read this, that you can see in verse 3 that they're quarreling and their jealousies and all these sort of things. Yeah, you can easily treat the problem. You can say, you've got to stop quarreling, you've got to stop being jealous. But what you've got to understand is that they are deep down, obviously, so unhappy. That's the manifestation of it all, isn't it? It's their unhappiness, their lack of satisfaction, their lack of peace, their lack of relationship and satisfaction and joy in Jesus Christ. And that all that's left is just arguing over this or that or this way or you've got or what I've got. Da, 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 da. It's just the world and it's all passing. But if we'll come to God, as we see that he invites them to do in verse 7, you see, yes, in the end there's sowing and there's watering, but God makes things grow. And if we feel we get stuck or the church gets stuck or we stagnate, God doesn't leave a thing and cause a thing to stagnate. He causes things to grow. If we'll come to God, we'll grow and mature. Yes? Great to see things maturing, isn't it? It's so of God to see maturity coming, to things coming to their fruition. It's so awful when you see those expectations cut off. Beautiful fields sown and watered and over the standing corn, and it's all swaying in the wind. It's just saying, come, come, come and harvest me. But just, you ever seen a field when it just goes over and nobody goes out into the field? It's just devastating, isn't it? Just to see a whole crop just going over. Or somebody's bought a beautiful bit of land, drawn up plans, they're so excited about the plans. And so we were watching, what was that program? Grand Designs. And they were fantastic projects and plans and brilliant materials, and the guy decided to manage the whole project himself, quite understandably. Imagine if you'd handed it all over to somebody else and you came back and like there was wires sticking out everywhere and trips and falls and hazards and the floor's not straight and, you know, nothing's been followed. It's just this shoddy bit of workmanship, if we've started with Christ, that's how we need to go on. I don't want to add Ben Midgley to Christ or anything else or anybody else. Just Christ, 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 right to the top. That's what this is all about. I think Christ is all right. It's good enough, isn't he? It's good enough. I'm full of illustrations today. This one has a particular person in mind. Maserati Gran Turismo. Does that mean anything to anybody here? Magnificent piece of Italian engineering. If there can be such a thing, it is so. Right? Beautiful. It doesn't have a key, it has a button. When you press the button, it's supposed to growl like a prehistoric creature. It's supposed to go boom, boom, like this. You know a Maserati Gran Turismo is coming long before you see it. You just hear this growl coming around the corner. Imagine if you sat there in the leather seats and all the rest of it. You sat down, you're ready, you press the button, and it goes, it's got a Citroen 2CV engine, 600cc. It's been embedded into the thing and potters along at 38 miles an hour. The church. It's the masterpiece of God. It's his masterpiece. We're in it. We've been included. We're part of the design. It's magnificent. And in his body there should be power. His power. His presence, his saving power. Otherwise, we just end up just like truthfully, a lot of people just see Christianity just another one of the religions. They just cannot tell us apart. Islam, Christianity, I don't know. What kind of, they do comparative religions. And we're in there. We're just compared. We're put under the microscope with all the others. We're exactly the same, just another manifestation of the religious phenomenon and sociological development of the human species. Not Christ in power coming from heaven, come amongst us, God manifest in the flesh, shedding his own blood as a redeeming sacrifice, that men and women, boys and girls, whoever it is that calls upon his name, should be delivered from their sins and saved to eternal glory and praise, that all people everywhere should know that Jesus Christ is Lord and that heaven should be filled with his praise and worship forever. As a living reality, as an experience for us all. And I think you can see in the burden that he gives the apostle that God cares about his church. This is the bride of Christ. Imagine here, those of you who've got sons and you're meeting the girl for the first time. She's brought home for the first time. You know, your son is going to get married and you love your son and she comes in. And this is the girl that he's going to marry. Don't tell me you don't care. He cares. Verse 12. He shows us how they should work. Paul and Apostle, they're not thinking about themselves. Paul and Apollos, they're just working together. They're just working together. There's only one church. We've got to work together, don't we? And there will be a reward for our work. If we work well, if we invest properly, if we give the best, we do our best, we work together, there will be consequences. You know, we've all been agitated, haven't we, thinking about the youngsters here going through their exams recently. We all remember what it's like. It's an absolutely dreadful experience. All that time we've been spending in school for month after month, year after year, and it all comes in a couple of weeks, all the pressure's down, and you've got to kind of produce, haven't you, this kind of answers to questions on every subject under the heavens. You've got to write it all down, and you're going to be assessed, and the consequences of where you go and what you do is going to be resting, at least in part, on the answers and the consequences. And you know that in some level, you know, your engagement with the subject, your respect for your teachers, your capacity to follow instructions and to appreciate the people who've been leading you into this whole process, all this is being evaluated and evaluated. And I was down there at the school gates and watching the youngsters getting their results, and I saw the tears and I saw the laughter as people kind of get their rewards of what they put in. You know, some of the people laughing didn't get straight A's. Some of the people who are laughing and rejoicing may have got C's and D's. But for them, that is a fantastic result, because they know how much they've put into it. They know the challenges that they've had to overcome. They know what that means to them, and they are thrilled about it. And some people got what looked like great grades, but they're not pleased about it, because they know they could have done that. They know they were building with wood and hay and straw, but they could have invested gold and silver and precious stones. There's a reward, there's an outcome. There's an outcome. Because we all get tests. We get tests, and that's what he's talking about. The tests will come. He talks about it like a burning fire. And we know that we're saved. It says there in verse 15, if it's burned up, we will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved. We're not talking about whether we're going to get saved or not, and that's why we can sit back and do nothing if we like, but I think our consciences won't let us rest. I don't eat crisps very often, and when I do, I always have the same experience. I go to the shop and there's the box of crisps, and they look like little golden pillows with their natty writing on them, and it's always like crisps, the best crisps in the world, and they're always a lot of money, like 79p or something like that. And you look at this packet of crisps and you buy this packet of crisps, and I understand the idea that you've got to put a lot of air in them because that's got to cushion the crisps in transit. I understand that, but I do think that in the end, even despite all the cushion, there should be something in there to cushion, because often when I open it, there's like five crisps in the bottom. You need to buy two packs, and I can't afford two packets of crisps at 79p a packet. It's disappointing, isn't it? And when the tests come, when we're open, you see, we can make a presentation that we're something. We can convince everybody else that we're something. You can believe, you can convince yourself that you're something. But in the end, when the packet gets opened, and we all get opened up, there better be something inside. There needs to be something inside. Christ. Christ in us, the hope of glory. Because, you know, we don't want to be made fools of, because we can convince everybody else, but you know, God is never ever fooled, never ever. He knows where we're at. He knows what we care about, our priorities. And if we could just come to him and say, this is where I am, this is how I'm at right now, I know what I'm attracted to, but would you just come and ravish my heart, and I want to follow you. Save me from myself. You've begun a good work in me. Keep going. Please, Lord, have mercy on me. Don't forget me. Humble ourselves. That's the way, isn't it? The beginning of this new season. Humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. Do you know the rest of the verse? He will exalt you. That's the best way, isn't it? That's the best way. We humble ourselves, he lifts us up. Presenting our bodies, reasonable service, living sacrifice. It's kind of duty sometimes. It just feels like duty sometimes. But duty's not a bad word. We're not serving Joseph Stalin. This is Jesus Christ.